grass, pot, weed, ganja, Mary Jane, devil's lettuce, hash, bud, tree, reefer. Marijuana is as iconic as its nicknames. The icon comes with a storied past, but only few know about. You see, history has been altered to serve political and ideological narratives, but tonight, we take a look at America's most debated plant and tell the real story of how marijuana imprisoned millions and made our government richer. Across the country, debates are taking place in living rooms, dining rooms, on television screens, and even behind closed doors in Congress as to how we address the systematically disproportionate levels of police violence against Black Americans. And for some, these conversations have been happening for years, yet many other Americans are just now beginning to critically think about these issues for the first time. Let me be clear. I am probably the most pro-police person that you'll ever find. I support our law enforcement officers. They're heroes. And, you know, they take enough shit as it is, if you will. The unfortunate fact is that the vast majority of them, in fact, all of them, are disadvantaged as law enforcement officers by our legislators, these individuals who pass laws that sometimes are unjust, laws that are sometimes, quite frankly, racist, laws that are not well thought out. We blame the police officer for enforcing the law. We blame the police officer for not enforcing the law. It's a double standard, if you will. Tonight, we're going to talk about marijuana and how it became illegal. Because, you see, it wasn't for the reason that you may think that it was. Tonight, marijuana remains illegal at the federal level and in most states. But why? Let's go back in history and examine that very question. You see, it was early in the 1800s, as early as the 1800s, that no federal restrictions on the sale or possession of cannabis existed in the United States. In fact, hemp fiber from the plant was used to make clothing, paper, and rope. Sometimes it was even used medicinally. But as a recreational drug, it wasn't that widespread. A New York Times article from 1876 even cites the positive use of cannabis to cure a patient's dropsy, basically a swelling from an accumulation of fluid. It's amazing that now, 150 years later, we are looking at the medical benefits of marijuana as we debate its legality. In 1876, it was spelled with an H, M-A-R-I-H-U-A-N-A. This is when the more sensational headlines about the drug began to appear. But you see, it wasn't until the turn of the 20th century that cannabis, as it was most commonly known in the United States, was a little used drug among Americans. It was the start of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, however, that many Mexicans began moving to the United States. And with that, they brought with them the tradition of smoking marijuana. Amid a growing fear of Mexican immigrants, sounds like a discussion that we've been having for some years. Hysterical claims about the drug began to circulate, such as allegations that it caused a lust for blood. In addition, the term cannabis was largely replaced by the anglicized word marijuana, which some speculated was done to promote the foreignness of the drug and thus stoke xenophobia. It was also around this time that many states began passing laws to ban pot. But it wasn't until the 1930s that Harry J. Anslinger, head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, turned the battle against marijuana into an all-out war. Now, some believe that he was motivated less by safety concerns, but by the vast majority of scientists he surveyed claimed the drug was not even dangerous, and more by a desire to promote his newly created department. Whatever the impetus, Anslinger sought a federal ban on the drug. And to this end, he initiated a high-profile campaign that relied heavily on racism. You see, Anslinger claimed that the majority of pot smokers were minorities, including African Americans, and that the marijuana had a negative effect on these, as he called it, degenerate races, such as inducing violence or causing insanity. I find that funny, considering how now we know that marijuana, for the most part, has a calming effect. Now, you might get some munchies or whatnot, but that's about it. Furthermore, he noted that reefer makes darkies think they are as good as white men. Perhaps even more worrisome to Anslinger was pot's supposed threat to white women's virtue. You see, Harry Anslinger thought that, and more so than thought, he believed that smoking pot would result in interracial sex with black men. I'd hate for him to visit Pornhub today. But I digress. Aided by an eager news media. Amazing. It's amazing how, even now, 90 years later, the news media somehow gets involved with government initiatives. Now, anyways, aided by an eager news media and such propaganda films such as Reefer Madness in 1936, Anslinger eventually oversaw the passage of the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937. This effectively made the drug illegal across the United States. Now, Anslinger was the first person appointed to lead the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in 1930 and had a career-long rivalry with none other than J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. These two constantly vied for recognition, and many of their tactics can be traced to a battle for public favor. It was among Anslinger's armory of stunts that he influenced the dialogue surrounding cannabis to inspire fear among common citizens, such as referring to the plant as killer weed. As the economy was crumbling under the weight of the Great Depression, jobs were scarce, and much of this propaganda was used as a racially divisive political tool. The political environment intensified when newspapers, especially those owned by William Randolph Hearst, popularized the formerly uncommon word marijuana hand in hand with the deceptive declarations penned by Anslinger. You see, this manipulation of language in the press played a significant role in defining cannabis in the minds of the public as a criminal substance used by Mexican immigrants, communities of color, and countercultural movements. You see, Anslinger was a man obsessed, and his campaigns intensified. Though none of them were founded in quantifiable research or fact-based reporting, he put his weight behind the Marijuana Tax Act, which was enacted in 1937 by President Roosevelt, which effectively imposed taxes that made cannabis and hemp so expensive to grow, transport, or even for doctors to prescribe. Public awareness surrounding cannabis was at an ultimate high, mainly because of his influence on the news media. And with their aid, it brought great attention to cannabis. In fact, Anslinger began publishing articles like Marijuana, Assassin of Youth, published just weeks before the Marijuana Tax Act was passed. Now, if you were to read that article, some of its declarations are laughable today. You see, that killer was a narcotic known to America as marijuana and to history as hashish. It is a narcotic used in the form of cigarettes comparatively new to the United States and as dangerous as a cold rattlesnake, he wrote. It was from there the battle to destroy all things cannabis continued to disproportionately target communities of colors, most notably in Harlem, which was a haven for displaced Southern blacks among jazz musicians, the Beats, and creatives who didn't fit into standard societal molds. Now, eventually Anslinger's scare tactic sought to tie cannabis use as an entry point to heroin. Say hello to the beginnings of marijuana, the gateway drug. Another fringe effect of Anslinger's steadfast determination to disparage cannabis was one of economy. As it turns out, anti-cannabis legislation, well, it's incredibly lucrative. Through Harry Anslinger, marijuana became an opportunity for the government to make money. And though he officially retired from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in July of 1962, his hold on the Bureau continued, almost as if he had never left. Mainly in part due to the fact that his deputy, Henry Giordano, was hired to replace Anslinger. Hiring Giordano was like rehiring Anslinger, but without Anslinger's strengths as a bureaucrat and public relations genius. Within a year, the Bureau was under assault from politicians wanting to kill the Federal Bureau of Narcotics because of persistent corruption. Now, I couldn't imagine an agency being corrupt. I mean, they lied about marijuana. They enlisted the help of the news media to spread such lies. They went against science, which is, by the way, one of the things today, you know, you don't want to go against the media and you don't want to go against science. Wow. It's amazing how history revolves. Anyways, I digress again. The FBN had been plagued by corruption since its inception. It was so bad that J. Edgar Hoover, the longtime FBI director, had resisted getting his agency involved in narcotics at first because he feared that narcotics prohibition would corrupt the FBI just as alcohol prohibition did. Now, looking back on J. Edgar Hoover as we know him today, we know that he clearly wasn't a saint, so for him not to want to get involved, that says a lot about Anslinger. Without Anslinger to successfully run interference for the FBN, as he had for 32 years, the Bureau suffered. Another problem plagued the FBN. Common sense reared its head, albeit briefly. And though Anslinger officially retired, rumors persisted that he was forced out by JFK, John F. Kennedy, who was keeping a campaign promise to hold a conference on narcotic and drug abuse at the White House. The Prettyman Report, the paper produced by the conference and written by E. Barrett Prettyman, a retired U.S. Supreme Court of Appeal judge, put it bluntly, this is what he wrote. There was simply no link between cannabis use and criminality, other than people being turned into criminals because they use cannabis. Further reports of cannabis dangers were grossly overstated. America's marijuana prohibition laws, especially its sentencing guidelines, the report concluded, demonstrated poor social perspective. Reporting based on anecdotal information suggested that Kennedy might have used cannabis himself. Now, Snopes investigated this claim and they found it to be unproven. While no evidence exists that cannabis was part of the medical protocol Kennedy consumed because of his various ailments, namely Addison's disease and profound back issues caused by his service in World War II, he may have used cannabis recreationally several times with a woman he was linked with, Mary Meyer. But we'll never know for sure. Responding to the Prettyman Report's findings, Kennedy appointed a Presidential Advisory Committee on Narcotics and Drug Abuse in 1963, and that roundly condemned the country's attitude towards cannabis. What had been a Mexican or black drug was rapidly becoming a young middle-class white drug. You see, the white kid who couldn't legally buy a six-pack of beer could often much more easily score a bag of weed. Writers including Allen Ginsberg, Norma Mayer, Timothy Leary began to speak honestly about using these drugs, cannabis especially, with nothing like the horrifying experiences Anslinger had described. You see, a whole generation realized that cannabis prohibition was based on outright lies. It was that realization alone that did tremendous harm to what a growing youth culture thought as of the establishment's inherent untruthfulness. If they lied so blatantly about cannabis, what else were they lying about? The truth about cannabis also filtered back to America via soldiers returning from Vietnam. In the book, Cannabis: A History, Martin Booth wrote, "For the U.S. troops in Vietnam, smoking marijuana was not a political statement. It was an escape from the horror of fighting and a recreational drug in place of alcohol, which is prohibited to American forces." On top of that, medical and legal professionals increasingly saw drug addiction as a medical problem instead of a crime. And for a brief moment in the mid-60s, America's commitment to cannabis prohibition wavered as its use spread. But the more cannabis use became a form of calculated civil disobedience, the more it became a target too. In 1967, though he had been out of office for years, Anslinger testified before a U.S. Senate committee that the lobbyists seeking to liberalize marijuana laws were really out to legalize it. Giordano also testified before Congress that many parts of the country had previously been free of drug abuse, now report a small but persistent traffic centering on the hippie elements and college campuses. Adding his voice to the establishment mix, J. Edgar Hoover sent a directive to the FBI in 1968 that stated, "Since the use of marijuana and other narcotics is widespread among members of the New Left, you should be alert to opportunities to have them arrested by local authorities on drug charges." Richard Nixon, who was running for president of the United States in 1968, had two clear enemies. First being the anti-war left and African Americans. When journalist Dan Baum interviewed Nixon's assistant, John Eshelman, in 1994 for Harper's Magazine, he forthrightly explained Nixon's strategy regarding cannabis. "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or blacks, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin. And it was then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." Now, although the marijuana tax was declared unconstitutional in 1969, it would be promptly replaced by the Controlled Substances Act the following year. That legislation classified marijuana as well as heroin and LSD, among others, as a Schedule I drug. It was with this new policy that a need for more police, for special task force, for lobbyists, and for prisons came. In 1973, President Nixon began to look at ways to combine all of the federal government's various drug enforcement agencies. By that time, the FBN had been folded into the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs in 1968, and they were able to take all of these agencies and combine them into a mega agency known as the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA. However, unlike Anslinger's underfunded, understaffed FBN, the DEA began its life with 10,000 agents operating around the world, in addition to a massive budget and extraordinary intelligence gathering powers with virtually no transparency or oversight. Anslinger finally realized his original dream, a potent federal agency with potent mandate to punish people. And when the Reagan administration oversaw the passage of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act in 1986, which changed the system of federal supervised release from a rehabilitative system into a punitive system and enacted new mandatory minimum sentences for drugs, including marijuana. It's too bad for Anslinger because he had been dead for 11 years. And after suffering through ill health, including terrible angina, for which the former FBI chief regularly took morphine. How coincidental. Anslinger died of heart failure on November the 14th, 1975. His death did not end our relationship with Anslinger. He impacts our lives to this day. He certainly impacted the lives of millions of people, far too many of color, who were prosecuted and punished for using cannabis. You see, perhaps unsurprisingly, racism was also evident in the enforcement of the law. According to some studies, African Americans in the early 21st century were nearly four times more likely than whites to be arrested on marijuana-related charges. It was despite both groups having similar usage rates. Now, since the 20th century, there has been a growing movement in the United States to legalize marijuana. In 1996, California made news as the first U.S. state to approve the decriminalization of pot for medical use. And medical marijuana was later allowed in other states. Then in 2012, Washington and Colorado passed ballot initiatives to legalize recreational marijuana. And by 2019, more than 30 states permitted some marijuana use, though it remained unlawful at the federal level. You see, marijuana has been a key driver of mass criminalization in this country. And hundreds of thousands of people, the majority of which have been Black or Latino, have had their lives impacted by marijuana arrests each year. But that tide is turning against the remnants of a drug war targeted at Black and brown people that was never meant to increase public safety in the first place. And perhaps we need to have that discussion now, because we're beginning to see more and more medical benefits for marijuana, as we look for that cure for cancer, as we look for a cure for chronic pain. You know, it wasn't until a few years ago that I seen a documentary on YouTube, and I can't remember what it was, but it was about two young boys. I think they were boys, twins, that suffered from hundreds and hundreds of seizures every day. They couldn't talk. They couldn't walk. They couldn't live a normal life. And their father was in the military, was stationed overseas, and the mother ends up moving to Colorado so that she can find a doctor to prescribe cannabis, because they tried everything else and nothing had worked. Long story short, it was very difficult to find a doctor to be able to prescribe cannabis to a minor. But when they finally found it, they had to get it the lowest THC possible. And the outcome was remarkable. In a period of a few days, these two twins that had been suffering from seizures for so long began to not have seizures, and they began to function as normal as they could or as they'd ever been. And it brought tears to my eyes. And then I realized at that point, because I had grown up just like so many other Americans, and I'd been told that marijuana was bad and it was horrible for you to get involved with, because if you start smoking marijuana or you start ingesting it, you're going to go on and you're going to become addicted to heroin or methamphetamine. You see, methamphetamine is a huge problem in this country, not marijuana. I'm proud. I'm conservative and I'm pro law enforcement. But we have created a problem in our country to where prisons are overrun right now with individuals that don't need to be there. If we're going to talk about anti-vaccinations, if we're going to talk about the government infringing upon our rights, it's time that we talk about decriminalizing marijuana. It's the point of the matter here, folks. It's time that we as a nation stand up and look at our country as a whole and decide what do we need to do to make it better? Because look, we got so many laws in the books, I guarantee we don't even know half of them. More is not always better. And the way marijuana was criminalized in this country was wrong. It's wrong. It should have never become a criminal act. But now you know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. I encourage you to do your research to learn more about the history of marijuana as a crime. And I'm sure, just as it did with me, it will change your perception and it will make you question a lot of things about our government. Until next time, I'll see you then. Thank you for listening to the Deuce Conrad Show on Spotify Podcast. In case you didn't know, you can also hear this podcast on Google Podcast and Apple Podcast and most podcast platforms across the web. For more information about tonight's show, you can also visit www.deuceconradshow.com. Visit show notes for more details.